Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. This month, the Ivy welcomes Michael Downs to celebrate the launch of his book, The Strange and True Tale of Horace Wells, Surgeon Dentist. Downs imagines the mysteries behind the true story of Horace Wells, who first used laughing gas as an anesthetic, reshaping medicine and humanity's relationship with pain. For more information, call 410-377-2966 or go to theivybookshop.com. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 387 for Friday, May 11th, 2018. The Maryland primary election is June 26th. Today, in another in a series of interviews, Baltimore State's attorney candidate Ivan Bates promises to recruit experienced lawyers to prosecute repeat violent offenders who, he says, have been getting off too easy during the tenure of incumbent Marilyn Mosby. Ivan Bates says the failures of Mosby's office have contributed to Baltimore's increase in violence, a long, depressing surge of shootings and homicides now in its fourth year. The city recorded its 100th homicide of the year this week, marking the second fastest pace of killings in the city in a decade. Ivan Bates, an experienced defense attorney and former prosecutor, says Marilyn Mosby's office has been depleted of prosecutorial talent, makes too many plea deals, and loses too many prosecutions of violent offenders. He also says he wants to emphasize fighting crime at its roots among juvenile offenders and in the communities hardest hit by crime. Marilyn Mosby has been invited to this show. We have not heard back from her campaign yet. Tharu Vignaraja is also in the Democratic primary, also a candidate, and you can find interviews with him in the Roughly Speaking archives. Ivan Bates was here for the first time in January. Here he is again. Just before you got here, the Sun sent out a tweet. Baltimore hits 100 homicides for 2018 at second fastest pace in a decade. You know, it seemed like things were slowing down there for a while, December, January, February, even March, and then we hit April, and now this is continuing, and we've had two teenagers killed in the last few days. I'm a newspaper columnist. I've run out of things to say about this, especially the last 3 years. It's been so intense the last 3 years. People are exhausted and numb, and you still have to leave room for outrage over these things. But you come slamming up against this question, why does it continue? What's going on? I mean, I know that every situation is different, but is there something in the water in Baltimore, something in the air? Is there something about the city that inspires such violence?
I think people have lost hope. People need to have hope. People need to believe in something. People need to know they can have a better life. When you sit down and look, we've become numb to the murders, and we can't be like that. We have to recognize the young man who was murdered in Southwest, the young lacrosse player who was murdered.
Team captain at City
captain.
College, yeah.
You know, those young men, they were sons. They were babies. They were children.
Well, where's the hopelessness, though? You said that people have lost hope. You lose hope, so you pick up a gun and shoot someone?
I think they lose hope in the sense that they don't see that they have a future. They don't see that society has something for them. What also you see is retaliation. I think after Freddie Gray, everybody began to pick up handguns. So we have to change the mentality of that, i.e., we can pick up a gun. You oftentimes hear, hey, I'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6. So we have to change that mentality.
Why did, after Freddie Gray, though, why do you say that? More people armed themselves after that period?
Yeah, oh, without a doubt. You know, as a criminal defense attorney, I was able to see how cases went from people being charged with drugs to all of a sudden people charged with guns. And people felt they needed to protect themselves. Remember, you had this huge spike in crime. You have all these murders. So all of a sudden people want to carry guns. When people want to carry guns, people have the gun, they're angry, they get upset, their emotions, boom, they shoot right away. Whereas opposed before, if they didn't have the gun, if they got angry, they had to run, get the gun. By the time they got the gun and came back, that individual they wanted to shoot was gone. You also have retaliation in a way that you just don't have it anymore. Remember, hurt people hurt people. This is a city that's hurting, and this is a city that doesn't have hope. But this is also a city that says we're not going to hold violent offenders accountable. So when you have those three things, There you have 300-plus murders.
We don't say that officially. We don't say we're not going to hold violent offenders accountable. I don't know anybody who would agree with that statement.
You know, I think our numbers bear fruit. Let's sit down and look at a couple of things. When you're a violent offender, they don't care about a guilty plea, because a guilty plea most likely is something where they get to go home. Violent offenders care about one thing and one thing only. Are you going to hold me accountable in trial? And when you look at those numbers in the state's attorney's office, the numbers that we looked at back in 2016, the Baltimore Sun, they published an article that Justin Fenton wrote. In the state's attorney's office, they won 175 trials, but they lost 237 trials. That really means for every 10 violent offenders to go to court, six of them are found not guilty. So if six of them are being found not guilty, what that says, because the violent offenders are sitting there on a tier in the jail, and they're sitting there talking about their cases, and they're seeing their friends and some of their homeboys they grew up with in their neighborhood, or people they don't like, and they're watching them go out the two doors, one the front door, everybody goes home, and the back door, the bus comes to the Division of Correction. They're watching them go home. So if six violent offenders go home, that tells that 17, 18, 19-year-old kid who's never been in trouble, who's his boys are saying, hey, don't worry, we'll be fine. But his mother is on him every night he calls at home, and he's crying on the phone to his mother. His mother says, this is serious. When he watches his friends all go home and then he goes home, now you've sat down and said there's no accountability for those actions. And that's when you begin to turn the tide. But we also have to give people the opportunity to have jobs. We don't provide jobs. We don't give job training. One of the things that I want to talk about is that, to me, is how you begin to give hope to these individuals. And one of the things I also really realized in being an attorney, you have individuals that have sold drugs previously. They have that felony on their record. They pled guilty 18, 19, 20, 21, sold 2, 3, maybe 20 pieces of crack cocaine. By the time they're 28, 29, they're trying to be on the right path. They now have an electrician's degree, a plumbing certificate. And guess what? They're making $16, $17 an hour. But yet, now the company has a contract to do some work, but they need a security clearance. They can't get a security clearance because they have a felony. So that security clearance may mean between $12 or $13 an hour as opposed to $25, $30 an hour. Why are we not going to Annapolis and said, you know, you passed this bill that said in 15 years you expunge nonviolent felonies. Why can't we make it 5?
Let's go back to criminal prosecution.
Yes.
And those repeat offenders.
Yes.
What would you do differently?
I think we have to look at the state's attorney's office. Right now it's decimated. In the past 3 years, you've had over 100 prosecutors leave, 800 years experience. I'm the only person in this race that a number of those experienced prosecutors want to come back and work with. They see what's happened, and they want to finish the job and do the job the correct way. But they want to have a boss who's going to be with them. My first week on the job, we're going to sit down and talk, and we're going to focus on those repeat violent offenders. I'm going to take maybe the 10 or 12, maybe 15 attorneys who are left who really know what they're doing, specifically 10. We're going to sit down and we're going to go through every single case involving a repeat violent offender. We're going to find out what's a real case where we can proceed and where cases we can't proceed. No, if we can't, we're going to null process it. And because it's a bad case, we're not going to go after bad cases. The good cases, we're going to sit down and look at 100. Those 100 individuals, my top 10 prosecutors, and these are the 10 that I don't like to see in court because I know what they know what they're doing, and they're very good. We will sit
you mean
down.
As a defense attorney.
As a defense attorney. We will sit down and we will go to court with those 100 violent offenders. And we will leave the message that violent offenses and shooting and killing people in Baltimore City is not accepted. And those 100 prosecutors that are new, they will sit next to the experienced prosecutors and they will learn how to do it the correct way. We're going to work on changing the culture and the narrative against violence in Baltimore City. We're going to change the culture in the state's attorney's office and show that office how to do it the right way, how to win the proper way, and how to work a case working together with the police to build good cases that the citizens can believe in. The citizens want to say guilty, but it must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
The last time you were here, and again just now, you made reference to the lack of experience among prosecutors in the state's attorney's office because Marilyn Mosby made so many changes and so many people left the office. So what would you do about that? Say you were elected, you become state's attorney next January. What do you do about young, inexperienced prosecutors in the office that you may not have much confidence in? Do you get rid of them or do you try to train them? And do you recruit experienced people to come in?
Well, people want to sit down and say, oh, we can recruit experienced people. It's not that simple. There's a shallow pool. And unlike any other jurisdiction in America, and I've done cases all around the country, and let's look only in Maryland. Baltimore City is totally unique. You have to understand, when you speak to a Baltimore City juror, you have to understand what they're dealing with. You have to understand, when they come to be a juror, they bring their experiences. And you have to understand the experience of a Baltimore City juror and citizen. So one, I'll do training in a way that we had when I was a brand new prosecutor. They will train every single Friday in the district court. They'll be taught from the very beginning. We'll bring retired judges. We'll bring former prosecutors. They've already reached out to me and said, hey, Ivan, when you win, I want to help. I want to be there. But we'll also bring at least 30 former prosecutors back. Like I said, I'm the only person in this race that they've reached out to and said, hey, you win, we're coming back. And these prosecutors went to governmental agencies. They want to be here. They want to do the job. Being a prosecutor.
So they're still in public service?
They're still in public service, a lot of them. The Attorney General's office, Prince George's County, Anne Arundel County, they want to come back. You know, I was a state's attorney for 6 years. So some of them we served with, a number of them I had cases against. So there's a way to correct this, but we must do it together. We'll have training. We'll have, there are even some judges who I've spoken to who say, hey, I'm ready to retire. I'd love to come back to that office. I'd love to work in that office. We will train. And one thing we will do, every single homicide will have two prosecutors sitting at the table, a senior experienced prosecutor and a younger prosecutor. That way they can learn the right way to do it. And that's important.
I want to ask you a question about what you've been hearing as you go around the city campaigning. Do people understand that that the state's attorney is somewhat responsible for the violent crime rate in a city? Do people make that connection? I just want to read you something. Making a prosecutor responsible for the rate of murders in a city is something like making the chief of surgery responsible for all the heart disease. Now, I wrote this in a column. I'm quoting myself here.
Yes.
But this is when Marilyn Mosby was beating up Greg Bernstein.
Yes.
And I was thinking, looking back now to when Bernstein was in office and she was running against him, and she was blaming him for the rise in violent crime. I mean, there are all these other pathologies in the city that you don't have any control over. You get the cases after the police and the detectives have made an arrest, right?
Yes.
That's kind of late in the going. But it is your job to get convictions.
It is.
And
it
get
is.
People off the street who would commit more crimes theoretically, right?
Yes.
That's what I mean, you've already alluded to this in this conversation, but what do people say? Do people understand that the state's attorney is a cog in this big wheel of criminal justice and trying to keep bad guys off the streets?
Well, it's interesting. I think what people see is our current state's attorney blaming everyone else, and people are confused and really don't really understand what's going on. People, when I talk to them, they want to change and they want something different. Everybody says they want to change. They want something different. When you sit down, you talk to people, you explain, it makes sense. Think about it. For a number of years, whether it's Pat Jessamy or Greg Bernstein, we were in the 200 murder mark.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, we have a new state's attorney and our murder rate skyrockets. Why?
For going into our fourth year now.
But you have to ask yourself, why? Well, because the state's attorney is the single most important part of the criminal justice system. The police make arrests short term. The judge's sentence, and that could be long term. However, the state's attorney must, one, gain a conviction, or two, gain a plea. 3 years ago, the law changed a case called Sharp, and it said the state's attorney, judges were no longer solely responsible for pleas. If there's a plea bargain, the state's attorney does not agree with it that the judge offers, the state will say, no, Your Honor, we don't agree with that, and the plea cannot happen. So understanding that. Also something that I've noticed with the change in the bail situation, the state's attorney's office has asked for more no bails. So when they ask for no bails, then you have individuals who are stuck in jail. When they're stuck in jail, it's time for to go to court. They'll sit down and plead guilty to anything to get out of jail. So you're seeing that the state's attorney's office is playing politics instead of protecting the citizens. They want to have a conviction rate.
So going back to bail, that point you're making, so we understand what you're saying, if the state's attorney is going for the no bail situation, because we've done away with this situation, right? Someone sits in jail and they're really eager to get going again, so they'll plead and take a lesser sentence? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir. So you have a case that you could potentially argue a fight and you're charged with first-degree assault. The state's attorney says, hey, I'll give you second-degree assault. But at that moment in time, you look at the guidelines. Guidelines may be 6 months. You've sat in jail 6.5 months. You plead guilty. You go home. You still have a sentence. You're still convicted. The state's attorney's office can say, oh, look at our conviction rate.
What role do you see the state's attorney playing in cleaning up police corruption or being vigilant and keeping an eye on it? This is another thing that the city is reeling from, the Gun Trace Task Force, this corrupt unit and all that it begot. And I know you're very familiar with it because some of the victims of this unit have come to your office for help, right?
Yes. Actually, I represented a number of them. Yeah. I was probably one of the main defense attorneys that was fighting the Gun Trace Task Force. Wayne Jenkins and I had a number of battles over the past 7 years.
That was the sergeant. The sergeant. The leader of these pirates.
Yes, without a doubt. Yeah. And the state's attorney's office knew. Once again, you have the inexperience. I propose a public corruption division that will look at the police officers, that will have a no-call list, and that will sit down and look at not just the police, but politicians and other governmental officials in terms of some of the activities that they're doing. But specifically in looking at the police department, you have the information, you have a complaint. Just don't call the officer. Let them sit down the sidelines. Take 90 days to 6 months to do a thorough investigation. Once you've done the thorough investigation, you can clear the officer or you'll charge the officer. But at least the officer knows, the community knows, we're not sitting around waiting to figure it out. One of the things that people don't realize, and I learned this doing a number of cases, the most important person oftentimes in charging a police officer or an investigating officer is a use of force expert. That's the individual that's going to tell you how the police officer is trained and if what they're doing was reasonably foreseeable in terms of what other officers would do. So those are the types of things that we have to understand. It's not enough to prosecute the officer, but to prosecute, you have to understand to when and what you're doing. And that takes the experience level.
Well, aside from going after repeat violent offenders and beefing up the office with more experienced people to prosecute crimes,
I think we need to reform the way we look at juvenile prosecution. The juvenile system is used as a training ground for young prosecutors. They're not invested. It's not that they don't want to be, but they're focused on going to circuit court. They're focused on going to misdemeanor court. I want to hire prosecutors that are invested in being in juvenile court the entire time, period. You know, when you look at that, they know the programs. They know what the kids should be doing. And we look at children, when I say children within the juvenile system, we look at them from a standpoint of why are they doing A, B, C, and D? Let's look also at why, how did they get here? And once we understand that, then we can sit down and understand the programs that the children, that some of the juveniles will need. I'm not an advocate for having them all in the juvenile system, but when they're in the system, let's give them the services they need. For instance, children skip school. If they're skipping school, they might be down the harbors, a group of them, then they're causing potentially some problems. Once that child skips school, the agent, the counselor at school can immediately send out an email to everybody, the agent, the court. The very next day, we can have that young man or young lady in court. We can immediately place them on electronic monitoring. And we're sitting there holding them accountable for their actions. And that's one thing I want to do. I also want to look at community prosecution.
What's that, community prosecution?
It's a model that New York used to drive down its crime. And basically, it says we're all working collaboratively. The government, meaning the state's attorney's office, the police, and the community. It can work two separate neighborhoods and will look and work differently. I plan to have two or three prosecutors assigned to each and every single district, and they will know what's going on. They'll go to community meetings. They'll know who the neighbors are, and they will sit down and go to the churches. For instance, there's Southeast. A lot of times Southeast crime is robberies, burglaries, some quality of life crimes. They'll sit down and understand what's going on. They'll know the neighbors that have security camera footage. Cars broken in 2 o'clock in the morning. The police and the state's attorney's office will know these are the neighbors that have security camera footage. We can download the footage and figure out who the individual was. And that's how we focus on quality of life crimes.
That's something that's not happening now?
No, there's
no
relationship. No, it's not the relationship like that. But what it also does, it involves the community. The prosecutors don't go to the community association meetings. Right now, it's community liaisons who really don't understand what's going on in the court because they don't go to court. They appear to be more of a cheerleader. But, you know, one of the things we sit down and look at is because that office is decimated, we have to fight crime intelligently and very, very, very smart. I go to church at New Metropolitan, McCullum Mosier. And when I sit down, there was an older lady who went and we talked. She talked about how she's afraid of the drug dealers. But she didn't really tell anybody that. And she's the type of person you wouldn't necessarily see. She was in her 70s. And when I realized, and telling that information to me and telling it to your church doesn't make you a witness. You can then give us that information. The state and the police, we put together a crime fighting strategy. She knew the drug dealers sold drugs only on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday from 10 in the morning till 2. For whatever reason, they knew that was the time period the police really weren't going to be in that neighborhood. Well, we can understand that, know that, have a police officer in a vehicle that drives up, have the cameras in the vehicle, purchase the drugs 2, 3, maybe 4 weeks in a row, or 4 or 5 times in a row. But once we have that information, we then take that information, identify the individual selling drugs. Most likely low-level drug dealers don't really have a record. But once they're arrested, we have warrants ready for their phone. Once they're arrested, they're most likely going to be released on their own recognizance or a very, very, very minor bail. But we download the information from the phone. And downloading the information from the phone, we can then begin to have a wiretap. There are only 4 prosecutors left in that office that even know how to do a wiretap. So we have to have realistic expectations about what we should do. Once we have a wiretap, we're no longer going with a wiretap from the top down. We're going from the bottom up. Because why? Younger kids tend to talk extremely reckless on the phone in terms of the information that the drug organization does not want to be released. And once they do that, they lead you to another person, lead you to another person. And then as the wiretap grows, then we can bring the federal authorities in to say, hey, can you now help us clear this entire corner? And that's what community prosecution looks like. It looks different for every community. It's no longer one size fits all. Now we're going to tailor make the prosecution for each and every single neighborhood. And that's how we get out of our houses and get to know one another.
So the primary is June 26th, and we finally have arranged for a debate, a televised debate.
Yes.
Which is going to be in early June, sponsored by the Baltimore Sun, the University of Baltimore, and WJZ-TV.
Yes, sir.
Have you appeared anywhere else with Ms. Mosby and Theroux, the other candidate in the Democratic primary?
No, we haven't yet. You know, sad because she was her previous opponent, Greg Bernstein. She went after him because he refused to debate her. And that's when we had 200 murders, and she said a crime was out of control. Now we have 300 plus every year, and she refused to debate. The citizens voted her in, and the citizens can vote her out. If the citizens think that it's okay that the person whose salary you pay does not have to answer to you, then you'll stay the course. And if this is the society that Baltimore City decides it wants to live in, 300 plus murders, being afraid. Remember, it's just not the violence. There was an article, 2, 3 days ago in the Baltimore Sun on Monday about the businesses closing.
Restaurants.
People don't want to come to Baltimore because they're afraid. If you walk around
there are
Baltimore,
other reasons given.
Yeah, there are other
reasons.
There
are other reasons given for why some restaurants are closing, some are opening. But you're right. Yes. That is in the consciousness.
It's right there. Walk around, knock on doors, and you see a number of houses in different neighborhoods up for sale. People are afraid. So unless we do something, Baltimore has an opportunity to make a change or else it'll stay the same. Baltimore has to decide its own narrative. So on June 26th, really, the question is crime. And who do you want to fight it the next 4 years?
Ivan Bates, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Ivan Bates is one of 2 candidates seeking to defeat Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby in the June primary election. He and Theroux Vignaraja faced off against each other Wednesday night for the first time in the Democratic campaign. You can find that story at BaltimoreSun.com. Marilyn Mosby has been invited to sit for a podcast interview. We have not heard back from her campaign. Meanwhile, Mosby this week announced her willingness to debate her 2 rivals in 3 separate events over the next month prior to the election, a gesture that Bates and Vignaraja had been demanding for weeks. So look for a June 7th debate hosted by the Baltimore Sun and WJZ-TV, a June 13th debate on the Larry Young Morning Show on WOLB, and a not-yet-scheduled debate this month or next month on WYPR. Be listening for more interviews with the candidates for governor, for Congress, and for state's attorney in the coming weeks. And that's our show for now. Your thoughts are always welcome by email, on Twitter, or on Facebook. Please tell your friends about the podcast, and if you get a chance, review our show on iTunes, your Apple Podcast app, or for Android users, on Stitcher. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Have a good weekend. We'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.